The Old Pilot's Plain Tales. The Last of the Phantoms. I'm on holiday at the moment, out in Australia. So I hope you don't mind if I do something a little different this week. I don't have a lot of time to record. And certainly I can't do anything very professional from the other side of the ocean. So bear with me if I read a chapter from a book called The Last of the Phantoms. The author is Ian Black, and he's probably the best-known fast jet photographer in Europe today. His material graces the covers of books and magazines all around the world. He joined the RAF in 1978 and flew Lightnings, Phantoms and Tornadoes, leaving in 1993 to spend 4 years with the French Air Force, flying the Mirage 2000. Now a pilot with Virgin Atlantic Airways, Ian flies ultra-long-haul A340-600s. He lives in Yorkshire. Ian's a lovely guy, and when he wrote this book, he asked if I'd be willing to write a chapter for him. So that's what I'm going to read to you this week. So it's titled Nick's Scottish Phantom. The squadron had deployed up to Kinloss for several months while the runway at Lucas was being resurfaced. It was great being right in the middle of one of the best low-flying regions in the country, so we took every opportunity we could to get down into the weeds. Even when we had to work over the North Sea flying intercepts, we would get there at low level, but only if we didn't waste too much gas doing it. Budgie and I were on our way to fly intercepts against an old Shackleton, and we were easing our way over the rolling hills at a couple of hundred feet. I was keeping the speed back to lower the fuel consumption. Not a clever trick, considering that I had a couple of wing tanks and a centerline tank weighing the aircraft down. I drifted into a gently winding valley, enjoying the feeling of weaving the Phantom back and forth. The turns became a little harder as the valley tightened up, and I already had full military power to keep my airspeed up, but without realizing it, my speed was slowly dropping. After a couple of tight turns with my canopy brushing the rocks, I found that the end of the valley was suddenly upon me, a sheer wall of rock stretching up into the sky. I eased back on the stick, but the aircraft was reacting slowly, and the angle of attack was building quickly. For a split second, I thought of tapping the burners, but with our temperamental spay engines, the afterburner light-up took several seconds, and in the meantime, the nozzles would open slightly, reducing the amount of thrust. I kept the pressure on the stick until the pedal shaker started rattling under my foot. The nose was coming up, but I didn't know if we were going to clear the ridge or not. I was holding my breath. The gap between some pine trees gave me a way through into clear sky. I clenched the cheeks of my backside, waiting for the back of the aircraft to clip the rock, but we crept through smoothly, kicking up a cloud of dust as the exhaust seared the ground. I lit up the burners to get flying speed back and hauled the Phantom safely up to 10,000 feet. Budgie asked what the problem was. He had been heads down watching the tube, and hadn't realised just how close I'd come to smearing us over a lump of granite. I sat there in a cold sweat, wondering if it might not be a good idea if I gave it all up. But soon the confidence of youth began to reassert itself. As lessons go, however, it was a hard one. We had the FG1 Phantoms on 43F Squadron, some RAF and the rest ex-Navy, from old Ark Royal. They were a bit of a nightmare, with some rather important bits and pieces missing. The FG-1 didn't have a parking brake, battery, or HF radio, nor in the early days did it have a gyro gun sight. Nor did we have an inertial navigation system, just a clockwork box of tricks that usually had us in the wrong hemisphere, let alone the UK. More than one navigator was led astray, but one crew in particular was caught out on a QRA mission. Well out of position, low on fuel, they dumped 8 missiles and 3 fuel tanks into the Atlantic and headed for home. They wouldn't have made it but for a fortuitous arrival of a tanker, which gave them enough gas to limp back to Lucas. The F-4 was a big, big fighter, mean-looking and aggressive. The cockpit was meaty, with little subtlety and plenty of sharp corners. The controls were large and imposing, with everything shaped and crafted to aid recognition and function. The only one I didn't really like was the drag chute handle. It needed a strong pull to lift it up, but if the pilot were to struggle and let it drop slightly before getting it latched into position, the chute was deployed and then unceremoniously dumped onto the runway. The main attitude indicator was a work of art. It showed bank and pitch, but it would also rotate to give heading as well. How it was geared, I have no idea, but it was beautiful and I always enjoyed instrument flying in the Phantom. When we bought the F-4 from the Americans, the British government insisted on using Rolls-Royce engines, and they chose the Spey. As an airliner engine, it wasn't really suited to the job, and although it was supposed to be more powerful than the original, it was heavier and wider. What we ended up with was the slowest, the heaviest, and the most expensive F-4 in the world. The radar we used was good, and in its time it was probably the best air intercept radar in the world. It was hard for the backseaters, particularly when running in search mode against low-level targets, as the display showed azimuth and speed but no range. One great disadvantage was the lack of an internal gun. If we wanted to go to war with our 20mm cannon firing 100 rounds a second, we had to mount it on the centerline station and leave the fuel tank at home. Flying the Phantom was always a challenge, and there wasn't an F-4 pilot alive who didn't respect it. Whilst it was a handful, it was conventional to fly until you tried to maneuver at high angle of attack. In this case, if the stick was used to roll the aircraft, the ailerons would cause so much adverse yaw that the aircraft could roll the wrong way and might even depart into a spin. Not a good idea in the F-4. So as the angle of attack came up around 19 units, the technique was to keep the ailerons central and roll the aircraft using the rudder. Not an easy skill to master, especially in a fight. The F-4 was the first aircraft I flew that had a tail hook. Big and reliable, it rarely skipped the cable and was often used to prevent overruns after brake failures or aquaplaning. The first time I remember using an Anger was on a dirty, wet night when the wind had risen above the crosswind limits. With 35 knots across the runway, my venerable and experienced backseater, Tony, suggested that tonight was a good time to see how it felt flying into the approaching cable. With the hook dangling well below the aircraft, I didn't want to plough up any approach lights, so I crabbed in right on the red-whites of the vases. The wire plucked the F-4 from the air before the main wheels were properly onto the ground, and we thumped into the runway and I bit my tongue. The wire jerked the aircraft straight, and with my nose up against the gun sight, we came to a halt. I've had worse landings, but rarely bled as much for them. The wings could be folded to save space or to wave at air traffic as we taxied past. But as one guy found out in Germany, it wouldn't fly very well with them unlocked. RAF Germany seemed to have its fair share of incidents with the Phantom. Probably the most famous was the day a very unfortunate crew, flying on an exercise with live missiles, shot down a Jaguar. The Jag pilot survived and ejected to safety, but the F-4 crew had a lot of explaining to do. The Phantom involved in this impromptu test firing now resides as the gate guard at RAF Stornoway. And the whole story can be found written in the inside of the Ray Dome, or at least it used to be there. I gather nowadays it's probably a bit old and has been scrapped. But I still possess that marvellous attitude indicator to tinker with and gaze at when I fancy a bit of reminiscing.